This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
Are you a fan of the video ref? Because people have strong views on VAR technology, especially at the World Cup. You might have been seeing some of these headlines. Controversial calls leaving some fans furious. So what do you think? Do you think video assistant referee tech is making sport fairer, or do you think it's overcomplicating things? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you. Coming up on Hack, we're going to get into this, and I want to hear your thoughts, not just if you've been watching the World Cup, but if you watch a lot of other sport that uses this type of technology. Get in touch, share your thoughts. Also coming up, we're taking you to a breathwork class. You're going to hear from some people who claim focused breathing has changed their lives.
It just like cracked me open completely. It was this amazing moment where I was able to just release all the stress that I was holding.
Yeah, you're going to have more on that very soon. First though,
Hack.
The experience of Jewish students and academics is in the spotlight, the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion.
On Triple J.
Yeah, we're going to start with a check-in on the Anti-Semitism Royal Commission because it's now in its fourth stage and the focus has shifted to universities. Jewish staff and students talking about their experiences on campus since the October 7 attacks in 2023. Now, many are saying they don't feel safe, telling disturbing stories of being attacked or harassed while at uni. So let's find out more now with the ABC's national education reporter, Connor Duffy, who has been at the Royal Commission hearings today and listening in. G'day, Connor. Thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
Can you remind us why this Royal Commission is focusing on universities specifically?
Yeah, so the Commission said that it had received a lot of submissions basically from the public about concerns about anti-Semitism on campus from students and staff. We know that universities were a real flashpoint for the disagreements after October 7 and Israel's response. Universities were home to some protests about the conflict, and there's a lot of kind of reporting into the Commission from students and staff that they not only felt unsafe, but they felt that university authorities weren't taking their complaints seriously. Universities, of course, have to juggle these competing responsibilities of being places not just of protest, but places where staff have academic freedom to speak out in ways that might get you sacked at another workplace. But then they also have the responsibility to keep students and staff safe and to abide by all the relevant state and Commonwealth hate speech laws. And the critique from the Jewish community very strongly is that the universities aren't getting that balance. That's right.
I mean, Connor, you've been listening in to the Commission hearings today. What have we heard and what are we expecting to hear at the Royal Commission this week?
It's been pretty distressing and upsetting, I've got to say, Dave. We heard from one young woman. She only had permission for us to publish her first name, Leah, who was at ANU. And she spoke about, you know, being a young person, 18 years old, moving to campus, living on campus, and really being shunned socially because she's, as well as being Jewish, a committed Zionist. She spoke about friendships breaking up. Then after October 7th, she said it got a lot worse. She said at those protests on campus that she was spat at, her and her friends were called names like Nazi and baby killer, and were left sort of, you know, in danger of missing out on that formative experience that going to uni is for so many young people.
And you've also heard from staff as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. We've heard from staff here. We heard from one staff member who didn't give us permission to publish his name, who spoke about students in his class giving a Nazi salute. We heard from another staff member from the University of Sydney who actually took action at Fair Work with a number of her colleagues because she felt that the protest encampment on site and a bunch of other things were making life really unsafe for her and for other staff members. So we've heard quite a few of those stories, and we're going to hear more tomorrow. We expect that the lived experience commission hearings will continue, and we'll keep hearing these stories from students and staff about their direct lived experience of anti-Semitism on campus.
Has there been any indication from some of those staff or students of what they would like to see come out of this Royal Commission, Connor?
Yeah, I think the big picture thing, first of all, that everyone that I've spoken to has said is that they want to feel welcome on campus again, not just safe but welcome, but then, you know, getting down into the nitty-gritty, they want consistent practices from universities, so there's proper procedures in place when they're complaining about these sorts of things. And universities have made some progress on this over the last couple of years. In its opening address today, the Commission heard that universities have taken some action and universities have admitted that they probably could have done a better job with this, and also that there's still more work to do. So I think some of the things that might come out of it going forward are those kind of concrete complaints processes and also some transparency around those processes, because a lot of the complaints we're hearing from staff is that when they do complain, they're told they can't talk to anyone about it.
So we are expecting to hear from some of those universities later on in the week, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So we're going to probably hear from some of the most high-profile and well-paid vice-chancellors in the country, actually, later in the week. They're expected to start giving evidence on Wednesday and continue into Thursday. And the people we know are appearing so far are the vice-chancellors of Melbourne, Sydney, ANU and Monash. And it's probably no surprise that those are the places that have been called to respond, because they were often the scene of some of the biggest and the most contentious protests about the war. So the universities will get a chance then to put their side of things and say what they've done since then, what they believe they still could do. We also think the Commission's going to hear from a guy called Dr. Alan Finkel, who wrote a report for universities on the measures that they've taken and the things that they could still do to improve the experience of students and staff on campus.
What about the government? Because I saw this morning a headline about a new anti-racism standard that the government has announced. What is that exactly?
So the government announced that before the hearings had started today. It's been in the works for a little while, and basically what they're saying is that universities will have to come up with a definition of not just anti-Semitism but Islamophobia and racism against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, as well as coming up with complaints processes essentially that are clear and transparent about what students and staff can do when they experience it. And the government's previously told me that they're going to tie this to accreditation, which is a really big stick, because for unis that means funding for teaching the courses that they do. So they're going to make it, you know, a really fundamental part of how unis interact with government.
No doubt we're going to be hearing a lot more about this, but thank you so much for the update. ABC National Education reporter Connor Duffy, appreciate your time.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we've got some messages coming through. Someone on the text line saying, I'm a Holocaust historian and I try and avoid going in to campus at all costs because I do get so many comments and microaggressions. I'm not Jewish, but just being associated with the Jewish community has made my uni life markedly harder since October 7. There's going to be a lot more evidence that goes down this week, as Connor was saying, hearing potentially from some of the big unis over the next few days, so we'll keep you across it.
Hack.
United States has unleashed another powerful round of strikes on Iran, Tehran responding by targeting multiple US-linked sites across the Middle East.
On Triple J.
Is the contentious Strait of Hormuz open? Well, kind of depends who you ask, really. It's been at the centre of heightened tensions in the Middle East over the past few days as the United States and Iran resume hostilities, the US launching more strikes on Iran. Jackson Worthington has the latest.
As missiles were fired back and forth between the US and Iran on the weekend, a war of words was brewing between the US president and Iranian authorities over the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump insists the Strait's open for business.
It's open. We bombed the hell out of them last night. They're very, very evil and sick people.
But Iran says the Strait, which has become a key sticking point in peace deal negotiations, is closed. Yesterday, Iran's parliamentary speaker, who's also the country's chief negotiator to the US, wrote on X, "The era of one-sided deals is over." This latest wave of hostilities kicked off last week after US President Donald Trump declared the ceasefire, which has been in place for less than a month, was over.
I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. You know what scum is? They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people.
The comments come after three commercial tankers were attacked in the Strait of Hormuz, prompting the US to launch strikes on Iran. Iran responded by attacking US military sites in Bahrain and Kuwait.
Across the Gulf region, nations are taking emergency action following a fresh round of US strikes on Iran.
On Saturday, the US announced it had struck 140 Iranian military targets, saying it's holding Iranian forces accountable for attacking another commercial ship. Here's the US's ambassador to NATO, Matthew Whitaker, speaking to Fox News.
Commercial shipping can't be terrorized in the Strait of Hormuz. And obviously the memorandum of understanding between the parties was always performance-based, and that President Trump, if shipping is attacked or if the Iranians want to act belligerent, then he will respond with overwhelming force.
The US says peace talks are ongoing, and Whitaker wants Iran to return to the memorandum of understanding signed last month.
And I think ultimately it is in their best interest to continue to work on the deal that was outlined in the memorandum of understanding, and that we continue to march forward to a lasting deal that not only keeps the Strait of Hormuz open and toll-free, but also makes sure that Iran abandons its nuclear ambitions.
The memorandum of understanding includes a commitment from both sides to work on a lasting peace deal. It also includes clauses related to the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz and the lifting of US sanctions on Iran. Iran blames America for violating the agreement. Here's Iran's UN ambassador, Amir Saeed Iravani.
The United States has once again violated its obligation by launching and continuing large-scale military attacks against Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
He told reporters Iran's committed to honoring the terms of the MOU.
However, should the United States continue to violate its obligation under the MOU, Iran will no longer be bound to fulfill its obligation under the MOU.
So where does all this leave us? Well, Hussein Ibish, a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute, says neither side wants to return to all-out war.
I think we're closer than ever to a return to all-out war, but there is this diplomatic pathway still open. President Trump does not want to go back to all-out war. The Iranians also don't want to go back to all-out war, but they're willing to. And I think that that's basically the difference.
Hack on Triple J.
Jackson Worthington reporting now. All right, we're going to shift gears a little bit and start breathing a little easier, maybe.
Hack.
It's so funny that now in 2026, like, we are paying for this, like, to breathe.
On Triple J.
Yeah, breath work. Is it something you've ever thought much about? Because a lot of people do think a lot about their breathing. They're even going to classes to learn new techniques. Breathwork classes taking off in popularity over the last few years. Have you done it? Have you been to one of these classes? If you have, how did you find it? 0439757555. Did it help you with something? Or maybe you did it and didn't really like it. Made you feel strange. It wasn't what you were expecting. Because more people are turning to conscious breathing to deal with stress, maybe help with sleep, even move through trauma. Does it work? And if so, how does it work? Well, we're going to ask some of those questions in a bit. But first, our Melbourne reporter Ariana Lucente decided to go along to a breathwork class and give it a go.
We'll begin our practice with three grounding breaths. So taking an easy breath in through the nose to arrive in a line. And we'll meet at the bottom of a long exhale.
That's me breathing. I'm in a dark room, a studio called the Breath House. I'm lying on a mat with a blanket, a weighted eye mask, and dozens of strangers, all breathing together.
Belly, chest, let go.
But what exactly are we all here for?
Everyone's moving at a really fast pace. We've got our phones that we're constantly on. I think a lot of people are looking for a space to really, you know, connect with their breath and release that stress.
It's a practice called breath work. And while breathing techniques have long been used in Chinese and Indian health practices, dedicated breathwork classes and studios are opening up around Melbourne. But what is it exactly?
Breathwork is essentially breathing intentionally to change how the body and the brain feel.
For most of us, breathing happens automatically, but it's also something you can control, which is where this kind of conscious breathwork comes in.
We've got our more down-regulating techniques, which helps us to drop into that parasympathetic nervous system where our body feels safe and calm. Then we've also got our more up-regulating practices, which is more energizing, more activating.
I met someone called Alex after the class.
Oh, I feel like I'm on a cloud. It's like hard to describe. It's just like so peaceful and so mellow and relaxed.
Alex treats it like self-care, a way of processing emotions and life stresses.
For me, it's just a moment of stillness. You lay down and you just really scan your whole body and you breathe and you're just like, oh, my jaw feels really tender or my hips feel really tight. And after you connect the dots.
While meditation is often described as being aware and present of your mind, your thoughts, breathwork aims to bring awareness to the body. It's what got Tara into breathwork 5 years ago.
I was a cop. I was in VicPol. At that time, I was feeling so much stress in my body. It just like cracked me open completely. It was this amazing moment where I was able to just release all the stress that I was holding. And it was a moment that I could just really come back to myself.
So what does an expert think about breathwork?
Every time we are doing something to make our body feel calm, to reassure our brain that we are safe, is positive.
That's Dr. Teresa Larkin, an associate professor in medical sciences at the University of Wollongong. She says this slow, controlled breathing activates the vagus nerve, which carries signals between your brain, heart, and digestive system.
So that lowers our blood pressure, lowers our heart rate, lowers inflammation. It's healthy for our lungs, it's healthy for our diaphragm, and this can be associated with a reduction in a feeling of stress and anxiety at that time. It actually does increase blood flow and oxygen to the brain. It can also then return good activity in the prefrontal cortex, so to get us thinking more rationally.
People have all kinds of reactions to breathwork classes, from relaxation to a sense of euphoria to a big cry. But Dr. Larkin says to be wary of studios making big claims about healing trauma, and that breathwork isn't necessarily right for everyone.
It is important that they do seek advice from a doctor before they start this.
One meta-analysis also found that while breathwork may be effective for improving stress and mental health, many studies on the practice had a risk of being biased.
Last deep breath in all the way up. And a big sigh out.
For some, breathwork can be spiritual, while others see it purely as nervous system regulation.
I think with anyone that's skeptical about coming in and trying it, I think if you can come in with an open mind and open heart and just to experience whatever might come forward for you, not saying it is a cure, it's just a really beautiful tool that can help you to be in the body and connect with yourself.
Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lucente reporting there and hearing from a few different people on the text line now. Someone saying, I think breathwork class just proves you can charge for anything nowadays, is that person's opinion. Someone else, though, saying breathwork has been a total game changer for me. It's helped calm my nervous system so much and helped with some chronic illness as well. I'd really encourage anybody to give it a try. If we stop for a moment and really focus on breathing, it can be truly life-changing. Look, there's also some people who are on the line as well. We've got Dominic with us. Dominic, you've tried breathwork yourself. You do it daily. How's it been for you?
Hey, Dave. Yeah, absolutely. So I was thinking that essentially breathwork came for me through yoga and through meditation. Mm. And essentially I use it to start my workday. I get to work a little bit earlier in the morning and I do about 10 minutes before I step in to work, and it's something that I really would find quite tricky not doing and not starting my workday with.
And how does it help you, do you think, Dominic? Like, if you don't get a chance to do it before you go to work, do you notice the difference?
Absolutely. I work in teaching, so I'm around a lot of dysregulated young people, and by starting my day with a sense of understanding of the breath, it allows me to sort of try and model that for the young people as best I can, of course.
Interesting stuff. Dominic, thank you so much for having a chat with us. There are a lot of people who do this on the daily and really swear by it, say, it helps me so much. Other people who are saying, look, it's not too new. It's just meditation. It's just mindfulness, that kind of thing. Look, let's get into this chat a little more with Dr. Gemma King, who's a research fellow at the University of Queensland School of Psychology. She's actually got a book out called Sleep First, and it's all about looking at sleep, what's going on inside your head when it hits the pillow. Gemma, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
Are we seeing a bit of a rise in people using things like breath work to tackle stress?
100%. What we're seeing is that people feel very disenfranchised with doctors who just say, take some medication or you have to live with it or this is just you. Yeah, maybe they've seen their parents not cope and they've seen the consequences of having to have long-term anxiety medication. Also, you know, it's free and it's democratically available. You don't need anything but your face and what Mother Nature's given you.
Do we know whether it is very useful for people when it comes to relaxing and sleep and those kinds of things?
Yeah, we're seeing much more research coming out, including my own. I've done some extensive research. And basically what we're seeing is what the ancients have told us for thousands of years is actually coming true. We're seeing some really good peer-reviewed, evidence-based research that's saying, yes, it can help. We've seen a lot of benefits about the ability to handle stress and discomfort and frustration, but we saw this really interesting result in our research. It was anecdotal. We didn't actually ask about it, but people were telling us that they really felt like they didn't want to vape as much. They didn't want to smoke cigarettes. They didn't want to drink or eat a lot of chocolate.
Issue, I guess, would be if there were people claiming that breath work could do things beyond its scope. People might be using this as a bit of a cure-all treatment.
I really think it can be quite dangerous. I'd be very trepidatious to be saying that breath work can cure this and that it would change your life completely forever and you should see, you know, your symptoms reduce. And that can also disenfranchise people if they don't see these really significant results or they don't see a reversal of their symptoms or their disease immediately, people might get a little bit disenfranchised. So I think you have to be very careful. If you're a vulnerable person, you're frightened because you've been given a very bad diagnosis like cancer, and people are telling you all you need to do is breath work, I think I'm worried about those people. I think false hope shouldn't be given to people who are in vulnerable situations.
Are there any at-risk groups who might find this a bit more riskier than others?
Yeah, definitely. If you're anywhere near water or driving heavy machinery or a car, you should not be doing any breath work unless you're in a safe environment, you're sitting or lying. Definitely, if you've got COPD, if you've got significant heart disease, lung disease, if you're pregnant with, you know, high blood pressure, these are some of the things that you should really talk to your doctor before you engage in some breath work. Because, you know, if you do it a lot and there's some of these breath work principles out there that can actually be quite significant. You actually see colours, you have psychedelic experiences. Some people can black out. So, yeah, I think start slow, start small, you know, make sure that you've got someone who knows what they're doing if you do have any of these conditions, and definitely speak to your doctor.
Dr. Gemma King from the University of Queensland, I appreciate you coming on Hack.
Thank you for having me.
And so many opinions on this one. Someone saying, look, to me, it sounds like a pipeline to total woo-woo and lighting the wallets of the people signing up for it. Okay, yeah, that's someone's opinion. Another person, though, saying, yeah, it works. It saved my life. Someone else, breathwork is great, but you don't need to pay for it. Just go to a music streaming platform and you can find it for free. Another person saying it's just kind of like yoga, but a new trend, a money grab for people in the inner city, that person says. And another person saying, I do find some in the breathwork world to be a little bit creepy. No doubt in the right environment, though, it works. All right, we're going to move on.
Hack.
The craziest thing about it is VAR didn't make a call because they said nothing happened. Everyone can see it, chat.
On Triple J.
Yeah, if you watch a lot of sport, there's something that you would have probably become a lot more familiar with over the past few years. VAR, or Video Assistant Referee technology. It's promised a lot. Less interference, more payoff. Is it all it's cracked up to be, though? Because some recent VAR calls at the World Cup have been slammed by some football fans, and it's actually not just football. It's other sports. It's tennis, the AFL, NRL. Sometimes the tech potentially getting it wrong. I want to know what your opinions are. Are you a big supporter of this kind of tech? Or maybe you're not happy with its current role in sport. You think it needs to change or be tweaked a bit. 0439 757 555. Look, let's dig into it a bit more with Dane Heveron, who's a digital reporter at Fox Sports. Dane, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Thank you for having me.
Let's look at the FIFA stuff first, the World Cup. There were two games in particular that have people really talking. What's happened?
Yeah, so yesterday, England won through to the semi-finals and they'll play Argentina. So Argentina beat Switzerland and England beat Norway in their respective quarterfinals. Both games went to extra time, really exciting games. England won 2-1 while Argentina won 3-1. But both games had controversies with the VAR. England's first goal, the ball hit a wire that a camera above the pitch was on, and somehow, like, in that situation, the rule should be that it's a dead ball and you restart with a drop ball and then play on, where they just let the game keep going, but the ball dropped down to an England player. That started the attack that led to their goal, and the VAR didn't intervene and rule it out when it has with other goals. Yeah.
It's interesting because it's upset so many people. As you can imagine, the stakes are so high at the World Cup. I mean, how does this technology work? Are there people, obviously they're behind the scenes, reviewing all the video and then helping the referees make decisions?
Yeah, so there's a crew of officials who sit in, it looks a bit like a bunker, like it's like an office with heaps of screens. And so they have contact to the referee and they will alert them if they've spotted anything. And then the referee will go to the side of the pitch and review the footage and then we'll make a decision based on it. But so in this instance is a little bit unique in that in this World Cup, they've got chips within each of the balls, which works so that they can detect if there's been contact on the ball. So that's mainly to tell if a player's touched it or not before, say, it goes out of bounds, or to determine if it's got, you know, put another player in an offside position. But in this instance, it didn't detect anything from the wire, even though the footage clearly showed that the ball dropped down quicker and deviated. And some experts have been saying that that's because the motion detectors that FIFA use cannot pick up a reading that high up in the air.
Yeah, I mean, there's been so much analysis on this over the past day, especially people writing opinion pieces, analysing what exactly happened, why it went wrong, whether we should be implementing this technology at all. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Dane Heverin, a digital reporter at Fox Sports, and we're talking about VAR technology, you know, video assistant referee technology, and whether you like it, whether you don't. We're hearing from you on the text line, someone saying the VAR debate has been going on for a long time. And in some instances where it is clear and obvious that the ref has got it wrong, it's great. But then there is this grey area on a decision that's where people want the technology chucked out. Another person saying video refs get it wrong more than you would expect, considering they have so much tech at their disposal. Yeah, Dane, I mean, it would be really useful in some instances, right? Because, you know, there are times that people have been really angry with the refs. That happens all the time.
Yeah, it's very useful in some instances. For example, during this World Cup, there's times where the ball ends up in the back of the net, the VAR shows straight away that a player was clearly offside. And that's a clear-cut decision where it's like, okay, that was clearly offside. Or it might happen if there's been a handball, for example, that you can clearly see that was a handball and the right decision gets made and the game keeps going on. But the problem that we're having with VAR is that just as the referee has to on the pitch, they're making subjective decisions. So everyone is not always going to agree with what happens, and that it's a game full of grey areas and interpretations, and every official and referee has a different interpretation. So we're getting different results from the VAR all the time. For example, one of the big controversies so far of this World Cup has been the VAR going back and seeing that there was a foul in the build-up play before a goal and then ruling the goal out. But it creates this whole can of worms about, well, how far back do you go? Because there's been some instances where a goal has been ruled out for a foul 20 seconds before the goal was actually scored, when in other instances that hasn't been happened, a foul in the build-up's been ignored and the goal stood.
Interesting. I mean, you can expect that there's going to be a lot of debate about this for years, and that's what some people are saying now on the text line. Like, it's been years already and we're still fighting over how useful this stuff is, whether we like it or not. definitely big thoughts on it. Look, Dane Heverin, thank you so much for coming on to explain all that. Really appreciate your time.
No worries, you're welcome.
And we've got a lot of messages coming through. Someone says, FIFA should review the tech. So many times goals are taken away from teams 5 minutes later. Totally takes the spirit out of the game. Another person saying, the video referee stuffed the State of Origin decider last week. Queensland was robbed. So frustrating. All right, that's all we've got time for on Hack for now.